Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi folks, and welcome to the latest edition of the Kitchen Garden Podcast. And I'm delighted to be here today chatting to Nick Hamilton, owner of the beautiful Barnsdale Gardens near Oakham in Rutland. Hiya Nick, how are you doing?
Hi.
Not suffering too much from the rain. It's pouring today as we're recording this, so it's nice to be out of it, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's one of those days when you're looking for all the indoor jobs to do, and obviously this is a perfect indoor job for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, I know I'm bound to say it, chatting to you, but Barnsdale is one of my favourite haunts. It's not far down the road from me, but it's a lovely place to spend the day. Got some beautiful gardens there, of course, and a lovely restaurant as well, folks, a lovely cafe, so I can recommend it. But we're here to chat to Nick today mostly about peat, or rather going peat-free, because I think I'm right in saying, Nick, if it's not already in place, there's a ban on peat in the garden centres, certainly from the end of next year. I think it may already be in I think it's certainly being phased out, isn't it? But it's a ban that's been coming in for years, I think. I think it was 2020, it was supposed to be here, and then it wasn't. And I think finally there is pretty much now an end to peat-based composts. And of course, at Barnsdale, you've been peat-free for years, haven't you? I think at least 30 years.
Yeah, I think yes, but 33. I think I've never used peat on the nursery at all since we started it, because when I came back to Barnsdale full time, and then almost a year later, we acquired the area that is the nursery, and obviously then having to build it and create, you know, the beds and everything else, put the tunnels in. It took a while to get going, but at that time, my dad was just starting to turn peat free, doing its trial. So we sort of went along with that. And a lot of the work that we did on the nursery was what he was then showing the viewers on the programme. So I was sort of working hand in hand with him. But I mean, the peat thing, you're right, the peat thing has been coming. And I keep saying to people, you know, that my dad was so far ahead of his time with so much of his thinking. The way that he was doing things and showing people, you know, all these different ideas that he'd had and information that he found out. And it's right, because they're still catching up with him, because, you know, 27 years later, they're now, you know, we're on the verge of peat being banned. It hasn't been banned yet in compost, but the amateur gardener, you're right, it's been, I mean, it has, to be honest, been almost 20 years in the making. You know, they've been talking about it for a long time. Now, it is supposed to be the end of next year. Whether that will materialise, we don't know. You know, we're waiting for the government and DEFRA in particular to make up their minds as to what they're doing, really, in that respect. But I think a lot of garden centres are trying to stay a step ahead. So a lot of them are starting to phase out peat-based compost anyway, and obviously, you know, making their available range of peat-free much greater. In preparation, the last thing you want is to be running around like a headless chicken when everybody else is trying to find, you know, pallets of peat-free compost to buy to put on sale for your customers. But, you know, we've been using it successfully in both the ornamental and the productive areas for, like I say, for, you know, 33-34 years now.
Yeah, well ahead of your time. Yeah. I mean, I've been trying peat-free compost for a few years now, or quite a few years, wanting to cut back on peat, obviously, but also, as you say, trying to prepare for a peat ban. But I know some of our readers as well had a few problems getting used to it, getting the hang of it. It's a different beast, isn't it, from a peat compost. I mean, there's lots of different brands. They're all a little different, I suppose, but take a bit of getting used to sometimes.
Yeah, there are substantially different types of compost out there. And this is the thing, is that, you know, people are so used to peat compost. And of course, whatever mix that you create, and you know, when I worked on a big wholesale nursery in Norfolk in the sort of mid late 1980s, you know, we probably had about 7 different mixes that we use for different plants, because of their requirement was different. And so when you look at a peat based mix, even though, you know, the ratios might be slightly different of what you get in it, it is still predominantly peat. Whereas when you look at a peat-free, they're made from all sorts of different things. You know, you go from sheep's wool, you know, right the way through, you know, coir-based, you get predominantly bark-based now. But there are also all sorts of different things mixed in with those. It is, a completely different beast to peat. And it is about, you know, understanding it, which is why I keep saying to people, you know, don't wait till the ban. You know, get some now and try different things. Because I think... You know, you must also find with your readership, as I do with the visitors to the gardens, is the fact that, you know, people have their favourite tools, you know, and none of the others are as good as the ones that they like. You know, they have their favourite seed company, and none of the others work. You know, germinators tell us the ones that they like. And but the point is that, you know, if you've got 100 people in the room, you'd get quite, you know, little groups of people that love what they grow and think that, you know, it's the only seed that germinates, and yet another group that has no luck with that particular brand but has a great luck with another. So I think with the peat free compost, it's about trying, because there are so many different types about. And also, you know, I think that nobody's really adding you know, a soil based compost really to their range, as far as I'm aware. I might be wrong, but I haven't seen any about myself. And so I think it may be a case of actually buying a peat-free compost and then adding to that yourself. Now, bear in mind that, you know, in the productive area, we're you know, whether it's in our garden, we have a productive area, whether it's on an allotment or wherever it is, you know, we're predominantly either in the greenhouse or planting into the ground. So, you know, even if we're using some of that soil, that we're not taking soil every year and not replacing it, because even if you're using it in pots, when you finish, you empty your pots back onto your allotment or your productive area.
It's
sort of recycling it. And I think that, you know, I don't think that they're the finished article yet, a lot of them. And I think that maybe, you know, people, by playing a little bit, I mean, a leaf mould is a really good thing to add as well, because that's a very sort of structurally, that's a really consistent material to use, to add as well, if you didn't want to add soil. So I think, you know, it's about having a little bit of a play, really.
Do you make your own compost at Barnsdale?
No, we do that, really. We use a proprietary compost predominantly, and then add to it. So, you know, we'll add our own organic fertilizer to it, because, you know, I think that the problem is that, you know, on the whole, a lot of what you get is not so specific anymore. So some of the bigger brands tend to be maybe just multi-purpose compost. And then you've got to, if you want to use it for potting on, then, you know, so we're growing our peppers, our aubergines, our tomatoes, cucumbers, all melons, all in pots and things in the greenhouse. So we're having to add fertilizer to that. And that, again, it's about trial and error. It's also about the crop. You know, the beauty with things like the fertilizer thing, because, you know, the joy with peat, take away all of the really bad bits of, you know, about using it. Obviously, we're just destroying all these peat bogs and all that sort of stuff, and it's terrible. But the great thing about it is it's completely inert, because it's been rotting down for millions of years. So whatever fertilizer you add to it is what's going to be there, whereas a peat-free compost tends to still be rotting down because of the material they use. And it's predominantly wood-based a lot now, or even the sheep's wool. They're still rotting, so they still will be using a certain amount of nitrogen and whatever. So it's, you know, there's a lot to understand about it, which is why I've been saying to people, you know, don't wait till the last minute, because it is very different.
I think the two things, as you say, most of the ones I've bought, you're never quite sure what's in it, because I guess all the companies want to keep keep the formula to themselves, and you can't blame them for that. So you don't often get, you know, this compost contains whatever. But as you say, they seem to be wood based mainly, don't they? Wood waste, I suppose it is. So still rotting down. So one of the problems I've found is they tend to get, they look very dry on top. It's almost a solid layer, and you think, oh, it needs watering, and so you pour more water on. What you don't realise is that the rest of the pot is still quite wet, isn't it? And so watering's a big thing, I think, isn't it? Trying to adjust that.
Yeah, everything. I mean, everything. But you're right with the watering thing, and it is quite difficult. I mean, you know, I get asked an awful lot, you know, should I water this? and the answer always is, you know, water it when it needs it. Because you can't, there is no definitive answer, you know, there is no definitive answer to that. You know, if you say to somebody, well, you know, I'm going to pot on my tomatoes. So, you know, and then I'm going to put them, I mean, we grow a lot of ours in a polythene tunnel. So, or tunnels, two tunnels. And so, you know, how often do we water? Well, it depends on the weather. But you can't say to somebody, water them every day or, you know, three times a week or whatever, because it could be cool and actually they don't need it, or it could be really quite warm and they do need it maybe twice a day, three times a day even sometimes. You know, so it's a difficult, but that's the point, is it, there are so many different factors to understand with these composts. We've grown up and got used with peat and got used to it. You know, it first came in the sort of the late 60s, really, didn't it, as a use in a sort of commercial environment, containerization, all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, we've both grown up with it in the horticulture industry as being the thing that you use for potting stuff on and for sowing stuff into. Yeah. You know, and so we've got well used to that. Now we're having to change and get used to something else. Now, obviously, you know, I didn't just jump on a bandwagon and say, right, okay, you know, my dad's not using peat now, so I'm going to do that, and I'm just going to do this. You know, we ran trials, we did lots of different mixes. In those days, it was predominantly coir that was being used. Now, you know, you pick up a Victorian gardening book and there'll be references to coir in that. So they, you know, it's not a new material. Yeah. They were using it 150 years ago. So, you know, then all of a sudden it sort of coir's taken a bit more of a back seat, and it's maybe being used within mixes, but it's not the main constituents of a mix anymore. It's more wood based. And so that brings it, you know, a different slant to it. And so we've had to relearn and retry again with things, you know, and there are, I mean, we found that a lot of the peat-free stuff that we've tried isn't as perfect as we would like it to be, and I think they're, you know, we've suffered a little bit of variation with a particular brand that we've tried, and, you know, and that's not good. So sometimes we've had to riddle a little bit, you know, to get some of the larger bits out of a multi-purpose compost, because we want to use it for sowing. It may be that we've got to put a little bit more effort in, but you know, the benefit of it is, you know, saving all the peat and everything else is worth a little bit of extra effort.
What about feeding with these composts, Nick? You mentioned that in passing before, but you need to feed a little more, do you think, than with peat-based composts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, as we said, they're still rotting down, so the bacteria do, you know, working on that process is consuming nitrogen. It's what they do in a compost heap. It's what they do in the ground, you know. So that's something you need to keep an eye on. And you know, I've always said to people, you know, when in the productive area, you know, when I run the courses at Barnsley, so I'm saying to them, you know, understand your pest, understand your disease, understand your nutritional, you know, deficiencies and what they look like. Because if you can understand those three things, then, you know, you can then deal with whatever comes to you in the right way. Because you see so many, you know, I get lots of people coming and say, I mean, I had a classic with somebody coming with it was actually a fuchsia leaf, so not productive, but it was a fuchsia leaf. Or several fuchsia leaves on a twig, and she said, "Oh, you know," she thrust this thing under my nose and said, you know, "What's this? I've been spraying it with fungicide and it's not killing it and whatever. And it was sooty mould, you know, so it was whitefly was the problem. And I said to her, well, you know, to be honest, you'd have been better off just burning your fiver instead of spending it on your fungicide, and you know, because for the good it's doing. And I said to her, you need to investigate and understand, you know, what's causing the problem. So, you know, I think that, yes, peat free does need more feeding, particularly with nitrogen, but not just as a matter of course. It's a case of whether it needs it. So, you know, seed raised is, it should be out of that, pricked out and you know, potted up or whatever, you know, into modules or whatever, before there's a requirement for extra food. It's the stuff really that once you get to, you know, potting into a, you know, 7-8 inch pots or whatever, you know, two to three inch pots, 7 to 8 centimeter pot is what I meant, you know, and you go to that first stage, then as that's growing on, you probably would want to feed a little bit then. You know, and we use a variety of different things. We will mix pelleted chicken manure in with our compost, and obviously the rates of that we've sorted out for our own purposes. There's no set rate, it depends on what you're growing and their requirement. But we always have the backup of using things like seaweed based feed or our own nettle feed, you know, that we make just by, you know, chucking an onion bag of nettles into a water butt. And people say, what ratio is it? I said, it's the ratio of whatever it comes out at.
Yes.
You know, but it does the job, is the point.
Not a perfect science, but it works. Yeah.
Well, but it's, you know, it just depends, you know, they don't react so rapidly that you're going to lose them straight away. They give you the signs that they're struggling a little bit before they go. So, you know, when you become nitrogen deficient, for example, then you get the yellowing of the leaf and they just don't look particularly well. Then you can, but before that, you know, as an organic gardener, your most important weapon against everything are the eyes. It's your two eyes are the most important thing, because you need to be, you know, looking for and dealing with things the minute that they start to become problematic. So you need, like I say, if you understand what nitrogen deficiency is, then you can catch it at its very early stages before it goes too far. Then actually bringing it, knocking it back into line, giving it a little bit of extra.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Feed will very rapidly correct that, whereas if you leave it 2 or 3 weeks and they become really quite nitrogen deficient, it takes a long time to get back. And certainly when you're producing crops, that has a massive impact on the, you know, the ultimate yield that you're going to get from that crop, which will be vastly reduced.
So I suppose the message with the compost is buy some and give it a try. You know, don't wait until you just can't buy your favorite compost anymore. Get out there and have a look and see what's available and see which one you prefer.
Absolutely. I mean, would you go and buy a house without looking at it first? Would you go and buy a car without sitting in one and maybe giving it a test drive first and having a go and seeing if it suits you and whatever? You wouldn't, you know, and stuff. And I dread to think how many people have ordered clothes online and sent them back, you know, because they're not what they thought they were. And that's the point. You can do that. But when with compost, you know, once you've sown into it, once you've planted into it, you have to go along with it. You can't go picking your seeds out and chucking your compost away and trying something else. You know, you have to sort of go with it. So, you know, what we've been doing is to, you know, is to trial small amounts of what we're growing, so that, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't really impact on what we're growing. So it's sort of almost, you know, so if let's say we're sowing, you know, French beans in pots in the greenhouse, then we'll do our, you know, 12 or whatever that we're doing for that particular batch, and then we'll do maybe a couple of extra ones in the new mix just to try it. If they don't work, we'll still go to 12. If they do, they might be stronger than a couple of the 12 of the normal ones, so we'll replace them with that. So, you know, it's over a wide range of different crops, because they all react slightly differently to things. And to do that, so, you know, it's about trialing. It's not as scientific as people might think in that respect. You know, you sow seeds into a new compost, see how they do, but you need to have a control to go with that. So you also need to sow them into another compost, either your peat base now, just to see how they compare. I have to say that, you know, initially the problem with the peat free compost many years ago, well, we're going back 30 plus years, was, you know, the people who were doing trials on them and then making that public were treating the peat free compost in exactly the same way as the peat based, and as we've already said, they are totally different. So even though you are going to try a control with your peat free, you still need to treat your peat free differently and learn about it. It's not going to be the same as peat.
No, that's really interesting. I'm sure we'll get a lot of questions from that, and as we get into the band, I'm sure, you know, we'll get people asking a lot about feeding and watering and everything, so I'm sure that'd be really useful. The other thing with Barnsdale, of course, is that you're completely organic, aren't you? So no pesticides either. So no. I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, how do you cope with some of the pests? I mean, we all get these things, slugs, snails, caterpillars, all these things. And you're well practiced at dealing with all these. So what do you, I guess, is it a combination of, you know, your netting, your companion planting, all those sorts of things combined to cut down on the pests?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think the difficulty is that, you know, I think quite rightly, because they're not professional horticulturalists, you know, the amateur gardener can become worried about lots of different pests, and they worry about things that they're not ever likely to maybe succumb to. So, you know, I did a talk to a group a little while ago now about how to grow vegetables all year round. It's a very short, very, very short version of my day course that I do. But I mentioned, you know, about growing onions and garlic next to carrots because of to deter the carrot fly. And a lady, I said, does anybody do it? And a lady put her hand up, and I said, all right, have you ever grown your carrots? I said, do you get carrot? You don't get carrot fly. And she said, oh, no, never had a problem with carrot fly. And I said, well, you know, have you tried it without the onions? And she said, no, why would I do that? Because then I get carrot fly. I said, well, not necessarily. It isn't everywhere, is the point. Yes, not everybody suffers from it. And they have proven that, you know, I mean, carrot flies, I mean, they're all their senses are honed to carrots, aren't they? I mean, you know, to us, an onion is very pungent. To a carrot fly, a carrot is very pungent, you know. So the thing is that what I've always found is if you can create, as an organic gardener, if you can create a natural barrier that will stop that pest from getting to your crop, then that by far is the better way, you know, to keep it healthy and to keep it growing well, if you can do that. Now, we can't do that all the time. So, you know, sometimes we have to say, right, okay, so if we can't do that, what's the next best thing we can do? Well, you know, as an organic gardener, the amount of product that you have in order to deal with pests is incredibly limited. So again, we go back to the eyes. If you go into your, you know, your polythene tunnel or your greenhouse or your tomatoes outside and you find a little bit of white fly on there, then take that leaf off. Take the problem away. Potentially, it may be the only bit that they've landed on. They've just started to lay eggs on that bit, and they haven't actually spread elsewhere. And then you take that problem away, you don't have a problem. And yeah. so, yeah. you know, if you can be there at the first attack of anything, whether it's a fungal disease or whether it's a pest, then that's one of your main advantages there. And then the rest of it really is about looking at organic products. So, you know, for our brassicas, for example, at Barnsley, we don't actually net against cabbage white butterfly. But the netting we have will stop the large cabbage white, but it won't stop the small. But we're netting predominantly against the demon pigeon. What we're netting predominantly. And you know, we use a product called Dipel for the cabbage whites. And it's a bacterium, and it's specific to the Lepidoptera butterflies, and that's the cabbage whites, both of them. And it's nice and easy because you can just spray it over the top, they ingest a bit, and then it kills them, you know, from the inside, and that's the way it works. You know, there are nematodes that you can use, but the thing with the nematodes is that they're contacts, so therefore it's on your hands and knees. All the caterpillars are underneath the leaf, trying to spray them and do it like that. So, you know, just being able to spray over the netting and doing that, we find really useful. The problem with Dipel is it comes in a container, and you know, you would have to live about four lives in order to use the whole container, because you only use a very little bit of it. And so we have several people that we all chip in and we buy this container, and then we divide it out, and that's the way to do it. So I think that, you know, the barrier thing is great, the visual thing is absolutely necessary, but if all else fails, then do that. But you know, we've found that, as with everybody, we find ourselves saying occasionally, I mean, it is rare, but occasionally we do find ourselves saying, well, there's always next year. And that's the final thing you should be saying on any crop, really, and stuff. But it does happen. You know, it does happen. And this year has proven to be challenging with certain crops because of the lack of light and the colder temperatures. And things, and we get that every year. And you know, if only we knew what was going to grow well and produce well, then we wouldn't grow quite so much of it, and then we wouldn't have to eat it with every meal. And then other things we would grow more of. But you know, it is difficult because we don't know every year what's going to be a problem, pest or fungal. You know, we found that fungal diseases certainly, you know, in the cooler, damper times were problematic. And so you know, it's about being aware. But I spend my time everywhere I go. I'm always looking, and so is John, head gardener John, always looking, and so is Susie on the productive areas. That's you need to be doing that, always looking for something that I don't mean that you need to be checking under every leaf in case you've got white fly or checking to see if you've got any botrytis or anything like that. It's just about, if you're looking around, you do tend to spot something that isn't normal.
Yes, yes.
And that's the point. So, you know, so in our greenhouse and polythene tunnels, we do use the yellow sticky traps, not as a means of catching pest, because they're, you know, the flying insects tend to be attracted to yellow, so they'll head for that. It's more of an indicator as to what's about.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's what we use for. So there are quite a few things like that, but we are very limited as to what we use. So for a lot of things like green fly, you know, we use an environmentally friendly washing up liquid. So you know, that kills quite a lot of the, you know, pest and things. You know, nicely cleans your veg as well, which is always good. and stuff. But like I say, we are very limited, and I don't see, for me personally, I don't see that there is a, you know, if you've got an organic pesticide, and Deris was the classic example, you know, been banned now and whatever. But if you have a, you know, period from spraying to harvest that you have to leave the crop, then I can't see that that's beneficial to an organic gardener. So, you know, what I want is something that I can spray, and if I come and I want to eat a tomato 10 minutes later, I can, you know, and that's what we should be doing. But I think, you know, that we can put out precautions, and we can also be very vigilant. And I think they're the two main things. And then if we have to fall back onto organic pests, and, you know, pesticides, then that's what we should be doing.
Yeah. I'm always very jealous of your veg at Barnsdale. Whenever I come over, it always looks amazing. So I think, well, how does he do it?
I can't take the credit for all of that. I mean, Susie's great, and she looks after all those areas, and she does a wonderful job. And we do spend, enough time discussing what we're doing and whatever. But I think that for me, with any employee, to be able to think, well, I don't have to worry about them. I can leave them to do that. And I know that every evening I've got veg waiting for me to take home, and fresh veg. And the point is, as you know, and as your readership know, there is absolutely nothing better than something that you produce yourself. It might be a little bit moth-eaten, but the point is that what we're getting is something that has all the goodness, it has all the flavour, and obviously, we're able to pick it fresh as well. And so there is nothing better. So for me, I mean, that's good. I mean, we straddle a little bit in production as well as education. So, realistically, yes, the areas are there are there to educate the visitor. But of course, yes, we grow to eat. So we grow in smaller numbers because we don't want to, we don't want to overproduce and waste things. And this year we actually, funnily enough, even with the low light, the tomatoes went bonkers, absolutely bonkers. And the great thing about the tomatoes is we can push those through the tea room. I love tomatoes, so plenty for me. But at the back end, about 3 weeks ago, we were having to bag up tomatoes to sell in the shop because we just had the tea room couldn't cope. I had more than one. Yes. We just were taking them home, and so we were selling them. And we had people, after we'd sold out, coming back saying, oh, we've got no more tomatoes. God, they were fantastic. And they are, because we're growing the right varieties. We're not growing just for yield and class A and all of that sort of stuff. We're growing for flavour, which is flavor. Important.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. Yeah. And you mentioned, already said, Barnsdale, great place to visit. But you, as you said, you're also educational and you run lots of courses. Do you run those all year round, Nick?
We do run them all year round. I mean, there are times when we don't do quite so many. So, obviously the summertime is everybody's busy. And when I say everybody's busy, I mean, people who would be normally attending courses, but also, the people who would be running them.
Yes,
so,
yeah,
we're all busy. And we do a lot. We do internally. So I'll do a lot and John does, several as well. But we also have external people doing stuff as well, which is great. But we do run them all year round. But obviously we're trying to, we target the times of year when it's right to do them. So, for example, if I run my veg all year round course, then I do it in earlier on in the year and also later in the year. So I run it twice a year because there is no best time to do it because you're looking to have as many vegetables as you can all year round. So, yes, where do you stop and start? You should be, running all the way around. So you're catching some stuff just right at one end and other stuff, once that's gone, at the other end that you couldn't show the first one. So it's sometimes we double up on things purely because there is no really good time and there are two sort of better times to do. But yes, we do them all year round. And we use, I view the garden as an educational facility. I don't view it as a tourist attraction, which is what the council do. I don't view it as a horticultural facility. It's a horticultural educational facility is what it is.
Oh, well, that's amazing. And obviously people can find out a lot more from your website. So if they'd like to visit there, and I guess the courses will be on there as well, or just...
Yeah, everything's on the website.
Whatever events you've got going on.
Yeah, it's just barnsdalegardens.co.uk and everything is on there. And yes, the courses, events, and we try and do quite a lot of those sort of things as well. But a lot of what we do is practically based. So it is, we always, certainly with the courses and with some of the things we do with the events, it's about making sure that people get and normal visitors, to be honest, people get given the information and are armed so that when they get home they can deal with whatever they've got at home with the information they've been given. It's not, for example, if you're pruning a rose, for example. There's no point showing somebody how to prune a specific rose, because when they get home, their rose doesn't look anything like that, and then they don't know what to do. So it's about learning the principles of rose pruning as opposed to, you know, stuff. So that's what we do, and we, you know, we always do it. You know what I'm like. I mean, I like to have a good, you know, fun, and I like to enjoy stuff that I do, and so I make sure that that's how these courses are run. They're not, you know, they're not hard work. They're good fun, and, you know, we have a good time.
Oh, that's great. Oh, well, thanks so much for talking to me today, Nick, and I'm sure the listeners will have learnt a lot about them, you know, going peat free and going pesticide free. So thanks so much. It's been great talking to you. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, Steve. Always nice to talk to you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.